Welcome to the With Ingram series of podcasts. I'm Philip Ingram. This is episode 8, and today I'm talking to Sinead King, who is an employment barrister with the 36 Group based in London. Warning, you might actually learn something. Sinead, thank you very much indeed for coming on the With Ingram series of podcasts. And today I understand we're talking about reorganisation, redundancy, and the job retention scheme, the business perspective of it within the COVID-19 pandemic that we're all suffering from at the moment as we sit at home and try and carry out our work from there. But for the listeners that are out there, can you give us a little bit of background about who you are and where you fit into all of this?
Sure. So I am a specialist commercial and employment barrister. I work with a wide range of individuals, businesses, external HR companies, tech companies, startups and SMEs. Really, my particular focus is providing legal advice and representation to SMEs and their employees in relation to all aspects of their business. So really coming into this, I'm somebody who is used to advising businesses on the hoof. Really in relation to all situations as they come up. So in some ways, whilst obviously a pandemic is not something that any of us anticipates, having to respond on the hoof to something quite significant as this is in some ways just an extreme part of the day job.
Now, you say it's something that businesses haven't really anticipated. Given the fact that it's the top of the government's contingency planning risks and local redundancy forum risks, a flu type pandemic, do you think businesses have failed to recognize the potential threats that have been out there and are now paying for it?
I think with anything like this, it's very easy to lose sight of the long-term or mid-term risks when you're in the process of firefighting. For a lot of small and medium-sized enterprises, often the battle of maintaining the normal day-to-day contingencies of a business has a tendency to be front and centre of their analysis. And there isn't necessarily the bandwidth available to think about those wider risks. I mean, certainly I think it would be fair to say that at a wider level, the fact that this is always something that was a contingency that was going to take place at some time has been off the radar across all sections of society. So I think it's certainly a moment for us all to pause and think about how we can regroup. But I don't think it's a responsibility can be simply left on businesses. This really falls on us all.
Yeah, and the government response has been absolutely and utterly massive. I think, you know, the unprecedented is not an overused word when it comes to describing it. Things have changed dramatically, have they not? But the impact for businesses and all the rest of it has been severe, because there's a large number of new laws and bits of legislation have had to be brought in very rapid order that no doubt are keeping you very busy indeed.
Well, in some ways, yes. In other ways, not so much. Certainly, perhaps the most significant piece of government development is the job retention scheme. Now, actually, there's very little law in it at all. It's simply two lines in Section 76 of the Corona legislation, 2020. And really, it's a government programme, which the further details of which, including any further regulation, have yet to be put in place. So legally, it's quite a small bit of law, which has an extremely large impact on the way in which businesses are organising themselves on the ground. Really, the scrabbling act for lawyers is simply how you fit this new bit of legislation into the general principles which govern these kind of situations. Because in some ways, obviously, a pandemic is something that's extremely novel, but redundancy situations, including where there is an economic recession and large businesses need to close down in a hurry or frantically rearrange the way that they do things in order to survive, that's actually not new, and it's certainly covered by the existing law.
Okay, so you know, how does the job retention scheme affect the rights of an employer to restructure their business or to make redundancies? You say there's very little law in there, but there's a lot's happening.
There's a lot happening, but legally, actually, very little has changed. Really, what a furlough is a very practical measure that's been put in place by the government in order to permit businesses the opportunity to pause to draw breath for a 3-month period whilst they start putting in place plans for business continuity. Mm-hmm. But the own situation on the ground, the right to make redundancies, the right to reorganize businesses, the absence of a right to unilaterally change contracts without the permission of the workforce, the risks of unfair dismissal if you get it all wrong, all of these actually remain the same as they ever were.
Well, that then ties in with a number of the risks that employers have in mind. What are some of the risks that you have identified that employers should have in mind when choosing between the different alternatives? And as an aside within that, do you think that many companies and employers actually realize what risks there are out there, or are you seeing them shooting from the hip?
Yes, I think that's a good question. So one of the biggest misconceptions about the furlough scheme is that it's compulsory either on employers or on employees. Essentially, this is a scheme that can only be put into place with the consent of both sides. And the danger, the biggest danger for both sides, is that if they don't understand that this is something that has to be agreed with as a result of consent, then they are going to approach the matter with the wrong idea of what their rights are. And as a result of it, they might not get an agreement where actually with a bit of negotiation and a bit of give and take, they could probably arrive at something that would work for both uh-huh. parties. So essentially, from the perspective of an employer, the risks are really in relation to what happens if they attempt to impose a furlough on an employee who doesn't want to go on furlough. The obvious risk is that the employee can claim constructive unfair dismissal. They can also, if they're a high-paid employee whose contracts have restrictive covenants in place, claim that the contract, quite apart from ending with termination, no longer binds them in respect of obligation they might otherwise have not to deal with clients of the business or not to compete with the business. So there's a real risk when it comes to really highly qualified, high status employees, that if you get this wrong, they could simply run off with the business. So that would be one certain risk that's definitely worth considering.
Yes, that's a scary one. I haven't heard that before. That will get people sitting up and thinking, no doubt.
Well, this is it. The other risks, obviously, are simply in terms of unfair dismissal for employees mm-hmm. with more than 2 years' service. Now, obviously, if a tribunal finds that an employee hasn't mitigated their loss properly, then the loss lies with them. But there's a real risk that if an employment tribunal found that this is somebody who shouldn't have had a furlough imposed, that should have been permitted to continue their job, who reasonably resigned in these circumstances, or was simply unfairly dismissed when they refused to furlough, that the loss of their income, which cannot not now be replaced, will lie with the employer. And that could be quite a substantial loss. There's also the issues of discrimination. So if you choose to furlough some employees but not others, and the employees who have to take the pay cut form a particular demographic, whether they're primary carers who are predominantly women, yeah. or whether older workers or disabled workers are selected for furlough but others are not, that again can leave you exposed to the risk of discrimination claims. Equally, from the perspective of the employee, if they refuse a furlough in circumstances where the business simply cannot afford to pay them, then they could find themselves at the end of the process out of a job with no way of actually recovering the money from their employer. So that's another thing that they need to think about too. As always with these kind of situations, it's simply a matter of sitting down and discussing these matters sensibly. And certainly what you would normally expect in any situation where a redundancy or a reorganisation were being contemplated, in order to make that process fair, you would expect employees and employers to consult, to warn, to consider alternatives. And in that position, if at the end of the process no alternative jobs are identified, then you'd expect that an employment tribunal would accept that a worker was fairly dismissed. But obviously, if alternatives can be identified in that process, including agreed variations of working conditions, that obviously would be a better outcome for both parties concerned.
Yeah, it's interesting. And it's interesting from the employee's perspective. I was told a story yesterday by an old friend who said he was talking to someone in a company where the boss has compulsory furloughed everyone and then threatened them with a sack if they tell anyone that they've been furloughed, because he's trying to keep a perception that the business is going. Outside that, I don't know how that's going to work, and I think he's digging himself a huge hole.
Yeah, I think the short answer to that is that's going to work badly from both ends, really. Certainly, one of the real risks businesses leave themselves open to is HMRC are going to be auditing businesses after this is over to check that people have been complying with the scheme. Now, the furlough scheme is very, very clear. You can't work. There are some limited exceptions. Essentially, if you are a salaried officer of the company, so it's a statutory officer, you can be furloughed in relation to your role as an employee, but still do the minimum things necessary to keep the business ticking over. But outside of that, you're expected not to do any work whatsoever, or it's not a furlough situation and you're into anti-avoidance territory. Yeah. From HMRC, that's not a good move. Certainly from maintaining employee relations and not leaving yourself open to a constructive unfair dismissal claim, asking an employee to tell the thing that is not true to protect the business reputation is exactly the kind of thing that is likely to find you as a company in breach of the employer's term of trust and confidence, and thus leave you exposed to a claim for a constructive unfair dismissal. And it, certainly on those particular facts, it's highly likely that a tribunal would say that this is conduct without reasonable or proper cause. So again, there's an exposure to tribunal claims and damages. If that course continues. So I think that that's one issue that's coming up in practice. Certainly another issue that has come up is it's high paid employees who now have other positions who are working out their long notice and they're being asked to be furloughed in circumstances where the furlough pay represents about 30% of their salary. And again, in that situation, they're not obliged to claim constructive unfair dismissal or otherwise treat the contract as an end. They can simply continue to work and continue to claim their pay, because essentially any worker, any employee who's ready and willing to work is entitled to their pay. And obviously, if that matter was to go to a tribunal, what we would expect in that circumstance would be a straightforward unlawful deduction of wages claims. Or if you want to take it to a court, to a claim for breach of contract, to which, again, an employer would have very little by way of a decent defence.
So what sort of risks should employees be thinking about? We've talked about the employer, but what about employees?
I think in terms of employees' risks, it is taking too gung-ho an approach in circumstances where a business is genuinely failing, genuinely has no work that can be provided. There is a redundancy situation clearly in the offing. A redundancy situation is where a business is going to close due to a temporary cessation of work. It can also be when there's a diminished need for work of a particular kind. A pandemic of the kind we are experiencing is about as central and obvious example of a redundancy situation as you're likely to find. Essentially, for any employee with less than 2 years' service, the risk they have is if they're not accepting furlough, they don't have a right to claim unfair dismissal, they don't have a right to redundancy payments. The risk for employees who are of over 2 years' service is, again, it's if this is a case where there is nothing for them to do, and instead of sitting down and working out alternatives, for example, a reduction, an agreed reduction of hours, a different way of doing things, then they can find themselves in a position where all they have at the end of it is statutory redundancy pay and no alternative work to go through. Because I think in terms of anticipating risks, you have the immediate 3-month period, which is anticipated by the current furlough provisions, but going forward, we don't know what the economy is going to look like in 3 months' time. So really only contingency planning for both businesses and employees is how can you best protect your position in circumstances where the risks are only just emerging. If you've got an alternative job that you're confident you can go to, that's one thing. But if you're not, really, it's a matter of holding on to what you can, insofar as you can. So really, the advice for both parties is it's sit down and talk about these issues sensibly. Really treat this as a problem-solving exercise to solve together. Very easy for me to say, and certainly cynically, as I tend to encounter workplaces in dispute far more often than I do coming together. Not necessarily that easy to do, particularly when tensions are high and everybody's responding psychologically to quite a difficult situation. But really sitting down and sensibly problem solving is my principal practical advice here.
Have you had many people come to you and ask for proper legal advice before they've sat down with their employees, or employees come and ask for advice before they accept offers from their employers?
It's beginning to come in. There's certainly employers and high earning employees certainly are coming for advice, but it's still very very ad hoc. And I think perhaps if there's a little bit more advice coming out, we've got 5 days before the portal opens formally. And I think a little bit more clarity. Over the last month, what we've seen is guidance has come in. There's been more revised guidance. So the unknown unknowns are getting smaller. And it strikes me that what we will see is that one of two things will happen. Either the guidance finally closes all of the gaps, or alternatively, there'll be a lot more queries once the scheme is up and running and on the ground. That's what I would anticipate in terms of queries.
Yeah, I think it's fascinating. There's a number of areas where there's employment that don't seem to be covered by the new regulations. But before we get onto that, you know, the next stage with employers, employees are now agency workers. How are they affected by the scheme?
Well, that's actually been simplified a great deal by the revised guidance. And I think it has to be said, the revised guidance is very good for just cutting through quite a lot of employment law complexities. Normally, the situation with agency workers is quite complicated because they don't have a standard employer-employee relationship. So the questions whether they're self-employed or whether they're working with an end user or an intermediate tends to be quite legally complicated. But actually, under the revised guidance, the way it's been done is very, very simple. The question is simply, is the agency worker on a PAYE payroll as of the end of February of this year? And the question is yes or no. If they're on a PAYE payroll, it's simply whoever is the person paying the money via that scheme. That's the that's the putative employer for the perspective of this scheme. So agency workers will be covered as long as they're on a payroll. Simple as that.
The whole thing's fascinating. Whenever people are furloughed and they're not supposed to work, it's interesting. I know a number of people who get income from different sources. Some of it is from a self-employed perspective. Others is they're salaried through their own limited company. Yep. Do you furlough from one and can still work with the other? There's another company that I know where the individual's lost all his clients, but is sitting down doing other related stuff to help in the COVID crisis, but doesn't quite understand whether he'd fit into the furlough scheme or not. When HMRC start looking at these things, I wonder how deep they're going to go into it.
Well, I think we will certainly see. But I think at the moment, because there's very clear guidance, which is it is simply, are you on the PAYE payroll? That's it. That's the answer. If you're on it, that's the end of the matter. Yep. You're entitled to be furloughed. Certainly, I think one of the things just in the last couple of days, I don't know whether you're aware of Carluccio's, the restaurant has gone into administration.
Yes, I did quite like Carluccio's, but oh well.
Well, hopefully they're intending to keep it going as a going concern.
Oh, good.
So what they want to do is to sell it on. But as of this Monday, what the High Court were having to wrestle with was whether or not the Carluccio workers could be furloughed or not. Because normally when a company is in administration, any any money is simply an asset which can be used for the benefit of trying to reduce the debts of the company. So the question was, well, what on earth do you do with these employees? How do you pay their wages when the only wages you want to pay them are furlough money so that they don't work?
Yeah.
And essentially the administrators were perfectly happy to furlough workers just as long as they didn't have to pay the bill for it. So what you've seen, and I think that's going to be the approach we will see from courts, from the judiciary going forward until further legislation comes down to clarify matters, is courts taking a very pragmatic approach to finding where this scheme slots in. So in this case, the High Court simply read into the insolvency provisions, provisions to cover the fact that these were varied contracts which were covered by the existing powers to take on workers within 40, to take on employees within 14 days of the administration coming into effect. And as a result of that, even though that this is a situation which isn't on the face of it covered expressly by law, this new provision was allowed to fit into the existing statutory scheme. And I think we will continue to see that. If the judges can, consistently with the legal principles, find a way of making this scheme work in such a way that the whole thing ticks along nicely, they'll do so. They will resolve all they can as quickly as they can. But as it is, it certainly seems that from the government, they're being quite responsive about closing the gaps in the way that the scheme's put together.
But like any new scheme that's out there, especially something that's been rushed in, you're getting everyone giving opinions from left, right and centre. So what are the common misconceptions that you're seeing that are out there? What are the common untruths that are being peddled around the place, which could get people into trouble?
Yes, I think that there's a couple of ones which can be quite difficult. One is that if an employee doesn't accept furlough, you can immediately dismiss them, and that will be fine. And I think that's a major one for any employee with more than 2 years' service, because you just can't. It's as simple as that. The danger, if you do that, is that they were going to be found to be unfairly dismissed.
Under 2 years, you can.
But under 2 years, you can, as long as you've got notice pay and all other things are equal. But again, if you find yourself dismissing workers with a particular protected characteristic or without notice, that's going to be problematic. Now, another thing that's certainly been reported nationwide is a particular supermarket was caught on record saying that anybody that didn't come into work because they were staying at home and self-isolating would be immediately selected for redundancy if redundancies needed to be made. And again, that also leaves employees of under 2 years service as well as over 2 years service potentially able to bring claims for automatically unfair discrimination claims because there's specific health and safety protections. So if you as an employee are put in a situation where your health is in danger or the health of somebody else is endangered, you're entitled to take either A, evasive action, or B, you're entitled to leave work without suffering any detriment, including dismissal, and including dismissals by way of redundancy. So again, for any intemperate employer who is threatening employees that they must come in and work in circumstances where they reasonably feel their safety or the safety of their family is at risk if they do so, there is a risk there that they might find themselves again in trouble with an employment tribunal in terms of their actions.
So I think in that circumstance, then the essential thing for an employer would be to prove that they've looked at that risk and made an assessment, would be to do a proper full risk assessment under the Health and Safety at Work Act, and then bring in as many mitigating factors as they possibly could to show that they're trying to mitigate the risk, and then assist that employees come in and work, or would they still be able to just not go in if they thought that they weren't being looked after properly?
Well, I think the issue is this: it's not for the employer to assess whether a tribunal will not defer to an employer's view about the risk. A tribunal will simply assess the question of whether the employee reasonably, in their subjective belief, believed that there was that they were being endangered by the workplace. And obviously the issue here is that we've got a government saying we now must, as a matter of law, remain indoors except in certain exempted circumstances, because the risk to our health and the health of everyone else is considered so high. And I think it's, obviously it's an unknown unknown because it's yet to be tested, but I think it would be quite difficult for an employer in that circumstance to say, well, sure, we are all being told to stay indoors in case we get, we suffer from this pandemic, but you can't reasonably assume that for that reason, we shouldn't be next to each other, indeed, you know, less than 6 feet away from each other. So I think that the difficulty is really, the defense is, if you have dismissed an employee in those circumstances, the question for a tribunal would be, would you have been entitled to dismiss this employer for the negligent way they acted in any event? Yep. So it's not as simple as we've done the risk assessment, so it's okay. Rather, it's, look, this employee acted incredibly negligently in terms of the way in which they conducted themselves within this scenario, and as a result, we would have been entitled to dismiss them on the spot in any event.
Yep.
So it's really the practical issues are, for example, supermarket checkout operators working close to the problem without the benefit of screens or other protection to ensure 2 meter distances.
Yep.
They might take the view that they are in serious and imminent danger of contracting the virus, particularly if they themselves have health conditions making them more vulnerable to contract the virus. And in those circumstances, I think a tribunal would be very slow to say, no, this supermarket worker was not entitled to leave the workplace.
Yep.
Or move away, or take some other form of evasive action. So really, that's something that employers need to think quite seriously about, rather than simply assuming, sure, there's a risk assessment somewhere, so we'll be fine. Not worth doing.
No, it's fascinating. On that one, would, because a lot of employers count people's absences through whatever reason against a league table for whenever they are reorganizing the business and making people redundant. Do you think that employers would be able to count any absences under the government stay-at-home scheme and all the rest of it, where people are self-isolating and all the rest of it, against something that would tally up for potential redundancies in the past? Or do you think employers would leave themselves wide open if that came in?
I'd say that. Oh, as a cautious lawyer, I always like to caveat it. I'd say they leave themselves partially open if they were to do that, because certainly, if someone has stayed at home to self-isolate because they're concerned about the risks, because they either belong to a vulnerable group or they are sharing a household with somebody who's in a vulnerable group, then on the face of it, this would be covered by the Employment Rights Act legislation.
Yeah.
And so any subsequent dismissal or any subsequent detriment that they suffered could be attributed to that decision to stay away from the workplace and take other forms of evasive action. So I think that's the risk there. If that's the way that it's done. And again, the other point I think there is that often members of a vulnerable group may also have a long-term condition with a more than trivial effect on their health, which means that they're disabled people for the perspective of the law. And as such, not only is there a risk in relation to the health and safety aspects, there's also a risk in relation to disability discrimination, where as long as the disability or something arising in consequence has a more than trivial role to play in the decision making, then an employer will be likely to be found to be responsible for an act of disability discrimination. So I'd advise employers to be very cautious in terms of their response to absences in this context.
So clearly your advice to employers and employees would be, if they've got any questions, to seek formal legal advice.
Absolutely. This is a complicated situation which is going to be highly fact sensitive in terms of the specific issues taking place in the specific workplace, in terms of the specific terms of the contract. It's very much a state of affairs where any employers is advised to get some decent specific advice, ideally before they have done anything they can't and easily
yes.
rely from.
Yes, there's no point in trying to close the stable door after the horse has bolted. But
I wouldn't go that far. There's always a point, but I think a bit of legal advice in advance is a lot more efficient than trying to get it afterwards. Yeah.
So how do any of the listeners out there get hold of you?
How do listeners get hold of me? Well, certainly the vast majority of my work is via referral from my solicitors. Certainly my clerks are very happy dealing with particularly with external HR advisors via the direct access scheme. But really, we're an extremely collegiate profession, and we're a very collegiate chamber. So just pick up the phone, and certainly there will be someone who can direct you to me, my colleagues, or solicitors who will be able to deal with whatever queries that they might have.
And that's the 36 group. And I'll put in the notes that go alongside this all the contact details for the 36 group and for yourself and all the rest of that that's in there, so people can get hold of you. Now, I did notice on your LinkedIn profile that you've written yourself down as a Netflix binger. So what are the series that we should all be watching on Netflix? What do you recommend?
Well, I have very much enjoyed, ridiculously said, The Last Kingdom.
Okay.
Which I think it has a nice mixture of homicidal Vikings, and basic consolidation and empire building. So it's 9th century England. The Vikings have invaded. The last kingdom is Wessex, and it is King Alfred the Great at the point when he's simply in charge of a village, beginning to empire build in quite tough situations. So good for the gratuitous violence, good for the epic performances, but also particularly in these uncertain times, extremely good escapist fun, which also emphasizes that even in times where everything appears to be very up in the air and uncertain, just keeping your feet on the ground and keeping on paying attention to your own resources, and you can build your empires. So yeah, Last Kingdom. Yeah.
Well, good gratuitous empire building as entertainment, I think, is a fantastic way to end. Sinead, it's been a real pleasure talking to you.
You too, Phil. Thanks very much for your time.